In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is George Benell, bass player in the Strawberry Alarm Clock, best known for their 1967 chart-topping hit, Incense and Peppermints. They're still active with 5 out of 6 original members, and they have a new album slated to come out this summer titled Where's One. Its release coincides with their appearance at this year's Tiki Oasis Festival, happening in San Diego, California, running August the 5th through the 9th. I'll have George on the line in a moment, but first we'll listen to a portion of the big hit, Incense and Peppermints, here on Your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Good sense, ill sense, crippling mankind. Dead kings, many things I can do. Your mind, incense and peppermints, the color of time.
Who cares for the games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose.
Incense and peppermints.
This is the Mighty Manfred and Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for our coolest conversations. My special guest is musician and songwriter George Benell of the 60s psychedelic band The Strawberry Alarm Clock, best known for their number one hit, Incense and Peppermints. The band is still active and performing later on this summer on Sunday, August the 9th at this year's Tiki Oasis, going on in San Diego, California, yearly festival there. George, my friend, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent and very happy to be chatting with you. I had read that that the band started in Glendale, California, and I'm here in Mount Washington, kind of next to Highland Park. But now, you were not originally from California, right? Where you're from Massachusetts.
I was from Massachusetts.
And what brought you to the Golden State?
My parents. Excuse me. And my grandparents. And we, they got the... They wanted to go after the orange trees and all that stuff in 1952, and I was 3. Anyway, so they moved us all out here, and my grandparents, my parents, and myself drove across country from Massachusetts to California, and my mom's cousins lived in North Hollywood and had a Italian, I'm Italian, and they had there's the hands. They had an Italian like restaurant and deli combo, and they had their house was behind it. We all moved into their house behind it, and my cousin had a band. Yeah, my cousins had a band, and I was only. They were like 8 and 12 or something like that. And they had an electric guitar and drums and a organ, like I guess it was a Hammond. It was a big piece of furniture.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. And I was completely bowled over as a 3-year-old. And we lived there with them for, I don't know, few months probably, and then my grandparents bought a house.
So when your grandparents bought a house, I had heard something about
at some point, maybe it wasn't next door, but maybe it was next to the deli that you, one of the Nudie Cone had a shop, the famous, that was next to your grandparents.
Yeah, their shop. They opened up a Five and Dime.
Okay. And next door is the famous Costume Desire and Nudie Suits. And were they, was he like playing music? Was that somehow tie into sort of your musical formative years? Or?
Yeah, totally. And by that time, I guess I was probably getting to be four. And getting up in the years. And so Nudie had a daughter that was my age. And so she was like, in those days, you went to the store with the parents when you didn't, if you didn't have school, and you know, you were raised in the store. Anyway, I met her, and we were running back and forth between the two stores. And who knows, it was just fun times, you know. And Nudie was always over there with all the local country western and bluegrass guys. And but they were like Pat Buttram and famous people, Doy O'Dell, Roy Rogers, all these people. And my grandparents knew them all. They loved my grandmother because she made Italian, you know, lasagna and all these things and brought it in all the time. And you know, Nudie, he was great. He had, you know, his cars had bullhorns on them and guns for, you know, the door handles. Really, it was just a completely trippy, fun thing to do when you're like 4 years old.
So you've got this country music going on. You mentioned your cousins having a band. What style of music were they?
They had the neighborhood was half Italian, half Mexican, kind of, and they were like the Midnighters. They were kind of like a Mexican. My cousins looked Mexican, unlike me. I was like the white Italian kid. They looked like, you know, dark Italian Mexican looking, and they fit. They went to school with all of them, and they all, that's what they did. They played in, you know, they had a bass player that was a kind of a heavy set guy, and he was something. He was good, electric, you know, and so I was just enamored by the whole thing, you know, couldn't get enough of it.
So we have this sort of you're still quite young, you know, 3, 4, 5. You got this, you got country picking going on. You got these guys, your cousins playing the stuff they're doing. I know in the band, you're known primarily as being the bass player. What is your first instrument?
Bass.
Bass was the first.
Well, when I was that age, when I was four, I started on violin.
Oh, wow.
And that was an Italian thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But then and then accordion. So there was like a progression. And
that's kind of a big. How little were you? That's a big thing.
I was sort of a big little kid, the accordion came about when I was about nine. But and I had a hard time carrying that thing to school as a 9-year-old. That was, you know, the school property. Same thing with the violin. You know, they supplied the instrument.
And so the choice of the violin first, that was your parents choosing?
No, that was me.
Oh, that was you.
I wanted to play fiddle, but the school wouldn't teach fiddle.
Okay.
You know, by the time I was seven, I was like in the second grade, and I was able to be in the school orchestra and play violin, but it was the musicals and the, you know, it was the Christmas show, the Easter show, Anyway, I was going, I wanted to do what the guys were doing over at Nudie's, you know?
Right, exactly. I can totally see that. In these formative years, did you already have sort of an idea in your head that you wanted to be pursuing music as a vocation if you could, or what was your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure if it was my thought or my mom's. My mom wanted me to be an artist, and so I was like I was definitely, you know, driven to it, and she had been an artist but kind of frustrated. She went to business school instead of art school to be with her friends. And so vicariously, she wanted me to pursue that angle all the way through school and all the way through high school. When I was graduating, I got enrolled in Chouinard Art School by Cal Arts. And the band made it.
Yeah,
it was the summer that I graduated high school in 1967. And I said, I'm not going to college. My mom goes, oh, yeah, you are. Same thing. You know, I lived next door to Steve Bartek. And
oh, yeah, let's talk a minute about Steve, because you've got, you know, he's your bandmate in the Strawberry Alarm Clock. And prior to that, you guys already had a history of playing music together. And
Yeah. From 1963.
And you met him when he was how old?
He was 11.
Okay. And you were what, a couple of years younger? Or
he was 14.
You were a little older. Okay.
Yeah. That's why he didn't become a touring member of the band. His mom said flat out, no. You know, when we both went in, we had been writing songs. And so we got invited to the band's rehearsal to teach them all of the songs we had written. And
okay. Well, let's back up first. So I know that you guys are quite young when you meet, and later on, Steve is playing, you know, guitar and Oingo Boingo and working with Danny Elfman, all this stuff. But you knew him first as a flute player?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's right. He was a flute player. He picked up guitar. As a matter of fact, one day his brother, Jim, and I had a band with another neighborhood kid, and Steve wanted to be in the band. And we told him, well, you can't play flute in the band. And, you know, what did we know? And so he said, okay. So he started learning harmonica, and he got a chromatic harmonica. And he could play anything because he could read anything. And so, and he was able to apply his reading to whatever instrument he picked up. It just somehow made related to it. And anyway, the same thing happened with guitar. He just picked it up one day, and he came in and showed his brother and I. He played Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And it was with all the passing chords and the moving parts and the little bass parts and stuff. And we sat there with our jaws hanging open going, what? But we had been taking jazz lessons, but Steve was already further along, you know, with jazz and classical music with the flute. And Jim and I were learning, I was learning walking bass, and he was playing all the decifonato chords and all that stuff. And
so you had started playing bass. When did you start the instrument?
Probably around 12.
Okay. And why?
Oh, I loved it. Well, it's the usual reason. Everybody else in the band played something else. And they go, well, you just pick up the bass. That's easy. You know, there's only four strings.
Well, I want to think about the formation of Strawberry Alarm Clock, because you mentioned you and Steve coming in to write songs. So there's, my understanding is there's the Sixpence, which exists as a band, and then were you and Steve in a band called Waterford Train?
I was, and Steve was not. He was too young still. By that time I was in high school, and Steve was like back, you know, in elementary school or no, junior high. And so he, for some, and his brother didn't want to be in a band anymore. And so I hooked up with other friends that I met at school. And that became Waterford Train. And then when the Sixpence and Waterford Train combined, Randy Seal was the drummer in Waterford Train, and I was the bass player. And Randy got the gig first with the Sixpence, and to go in and do vocals and stuff. And then the drummer quit, so they asked him to be the drummer, and then he wanted to bring his bass player along. which was me.
Right.
And so, you know, at that time we went down to the studio and played on all the tracks. They said, you play the bass parts because you know them. They had a bass player, but he was not right on Johnny on the spot with any learning.
Because now the Sixpence, they had like half a dozen singles out already.
Yeah, I mean, that was the deal. They had a manager that was had started his own record company, All American Records, and they were putting them out. They were getting, you know, putting them on the radio at least in Santa Barbara. You know, they had something going on. You know, to us, you know, we had nothing, and so. Then when we were in the studio, they said, would you guys be in the band? And so I said, yeah. And I'm 18 and Steve was only 15. And so we go home and my dad drove us to this recording session. So he was fine with everything.
So this recording, when you talk about the recording session, on the first album, you and Steve contribute some songs.
Yeah.
But now the actual session for Incense and Peppermints, that had already taken place before you were in the band?
That had taken place earlier. And Gene Gunnels played drums on it. And then his girlfriend gave him an ultimatum because nothing was really going on with their band. And she said, you have to make a choice between me and the band. Either you get a job at McDonald's or I'm leaving you. So he comes to the band and says, I have to leave, you know, so he quits the band, goes and gets a job at McDonald's. In the interim, they had Randy come over to do harmonies and stuff on Incense and Peppermints.
And now, and Randy, let's be clear, Randy is the, he is, who is Randy? Is that the singer?
He's the drummer of Waterford Train.
Train, right, okay.
Yeah. And they said, you know, do you want to play drums to Randy? Because Gene quit. Well, he's already there doing vocals on Incense. So he says, yeah, but I'll bring my bass player. That's how the whole thing with me came. But, and he goes, and George and Steve have a bunch of songs. But what ends up happening is Steve, he and I wrote songs every day after school. So we always were next door to each other and we always played. But he wasn't in Waterford Train. But until Randy and I left Waterford Train, they changed their name to Public Bubble, had Steve come in and replace me, be the bass player. And they had another friend of ours from high school, Bruce Hubbard, come in and play drums. And Gene Gunnels was at McDonald's.
No, literally, was he really at McDonald's? Really? Wow. So that wasn't just a metaphor for getting...
No, I used to tell it on stage and the band made me stop.
I mean, I worked at McDonald's, but, you know, that was...
You did? Oh,
yeah, yeah, go. Yeah. In fact, that was a long time ago. But that was the first high school job that I had. Can we talk about Incense and Peppermints? Do you know any?
Because
you're kind of the historian for the band, and the story of the song that I'm familiar with is that Ed King, the guitar player, and Mark Welts, right, the keyboard player, they have written different music parts. Like maybe Ed did the bridge, and Mark came up with kind of a verse part, and they kind of had this music, but they didn't have any song lyrics, or they did or not.
No, what they had done is they had written, Mark first wrote all the, you know, the Farfisa organ thing, and he actually doubles the part, the Farfisa, on a grand piano on the record, but it's blended together so tight.
Right.
But anyway, Mark had written the whole body of music. And then he got stuck at the bridge and had Ed come over, which is something that he kind of did after that all the time anyway.
Yeah.
But Ed come over and work out the idea for the bridge. And it was the actual bridge that you hear. So they went in the studio. They didn't intend for it to be a song that you sing. It was going to be just an instrumental.
Yeah.
And so they went in and it was also intended to just be the B-side of the single that they had just recorded, which was called The Birdman of Alcatraz, which they were trying to do a novelty song, something to break through. You know, they were anything. And so the Birdman of Alcatraz was cute and everything, and Mark sang it. And it is the flip side of Incense, as it turns out, but it was originally going to be the A side. And Incense and Peppermints was an instrumental. Well, Frank Slay, the band's producer, when he heard the music, he said, you know, one of my writers, he had a publishing company too, and Claridge Music. And he said, one of my writers has a title, but no lyrics, it's just Incense and Peppermints. And he goes, and I think it fits this music. To me, in my head, it sounds like it. And, you know, he was a sharp guy. And he was right. You know, they had already recorded what you hear as the, you know, the classic single.
Right.
Music was done. And they sent that music track to John Carter, the writer that had Incense and Peppermints. And so they said, you know, come up with a body of lyrics and bring it to the band and teach it to the band. So he was in Denver. Carter comes back to Los Angeles mm-hmm. from Denver, and he's got the lyrics on just handwritten. And he told the band, you know, because Frank kept bugging him. It was like 2 weeks had gone by.
Yeah.
And he was like, where are these lyrics, you know? And so he went to the airport, and he said, because I talked to Carter later, and he told me that he really didn't have the lyrics done. And at the airport, he went to the bathroom and was writing on the thing that you sit on paper.
Yeah, and yeah. Well, you have to be very careful with that paper. It'll tear real easy.
Yeah, yeah. And he had a rhyming dictionary. And he said he just kept putting he started off with the title with Incense and Peppermints in it, and it was nouns. And he kept putting different nouns together and until he came up with that, and he tied them together with little weird things. And it came out really cool, you know. And so.
So in the John, he passed a hit.
Yes, he passed a hit. And when he came to the band, I hear both sides, because you know, some of the guys who are no longer with us, like Lee Freeman and Ed King, and, you know, they were like, I don't know, you know, they were kind of, they didn't know and Mark was, oh, it's okay, they're pretty cool lyrics, you know, and so. And Randy said, well, I'll try to sing it, you know, and everybody was trying to sing it. And Carter was teaching it to everybody in the studio.
Yeah.
And nobody's voice fit it. And of course, you know, in those days, there was no
auto-tuning,
speed control or anything to change the key.
Yeah.
And so they were stuck with what it was, because the music was done.
Yeah.
And so they ended up having Greg Munford, who was also with the same manager and producer and always at the sessions.
Okay.
Even I knew him. I used to go hang out at the sessions because I was friends with Randy Seal. So he used to bring me along and, you know.
And so Greg was in other bands?
He was in other bands, yeah. He was in a band, the Crystal Circus, and I forget what this other band was, but Greg was, I used to really like him, and he had a bunch of singles just like the Sixpence did, you know, on the All American label. And I remember Greg gave me a couple of his singles that were cool. And, I have them somewhere. They're probably worth something, but, anyway, I liked his voice. He was more like a alternative kind of a guy now. He would fit in now.
Yeah.
And anyway, they let him take a pass at singing it. They said, come on, it's just going to be the B-side. It doesn't matter. It's kind of a demo anyway. So they had Greg sing it. And the producer went, that's perfect. Go with it. And Carter liked it too. So they just, you know, lock and load. That was it. And they still didn't know that it was, you know, they sent it, the record to KIST in Santa Barbara, Johnny Fairchild, and asked him to play it. And they told him that Incense was, you know, the B side and Birdman was the A side. And Fairchild listened to them and said, you're crazy. You're crazy. This Incense, this is good. He goes, I'm going to start playing this. And it became the number one most requested song in Santa Barbara for like the first week. And it was really, it was going to be for another week too. And
it got picked up by Uni.
Yeah, they got picked up by Uni right after that. Well, there was a little more of going around to by that time, I'm part of the deal. And they dragged me in. And so they're going around to radio stations. Like, because Johnny knew different disc jockeys for them to go. He goes, here, take it to this guy, take it to this. So it was like, you know, Palm Springs, San Diego, all around the local thing. And when it came back to L.A., it was Dave Diamond. He had a show on, there was a radio station called KBLA, and it was like everybody thought of it as the underground radio station.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And he had a show called The Diamond Mind. And so he played it. He liked it, but I think he was a payola guy. I think that our manager paid him because it was like about 3 weeks later, we're in the studio recording and Dave Diamond comes in and he goes, and he gets a check from the manager and he goes, well, boys, it's been a pleasure doing business with you. And we're like, oh, whatever. You know, we didn't know what payola was. Yeah. But I'm sure that's what that one was.
Yeah, that one was. But the record was taking off overall.
Yes, and it in L.A. it did the same thing. Number one most requested, and then Uni picked it up,
and then off to the races.
Yeah, you know what they had this guy, Bill Gavin, I think they had the Gavin.
Oh, the Gavin Report. I remember. Yeah.
Well, he had all these stations. Yeah, he was. Yeah. Programmer and he had all these stations all across the country, like 250 or something. He took it and just it was like from after the months of it being like hard work, all of a sudden it was like off on its own, and it just took off.
I was going to ask you about like the Frank Slay guy is a longtime producer from an era of like. Hits guy, right? He knows hits and he worked on hits. And now this is the singles in 67. It's getting towards the late 60s. Did you guys continue to work with him? Or I was wondering, it's that, you know, as the 60s go on, there's more of an emphasis, certainly from the artist's perspective, on albums, as opposed to these guys who are, you know, cut their teeth in the late beginning of the 50s and into the 60s, where they're all about hit records, like a single. But a lot of the artists by the end of the 60s were thinking in terms of a whole album. Was there any, frustration or conflict or stress between like what the record company wanted in terms of hits or what you guys were trying to develop artistically? What was the dynamic there?
A really, really good question and good area for this band. Frank Slay was great, you know, but yes, he was a hit maker, and he knew he was quick to, you know, like if I wasn't getting a bass part in the first take, he goes, yeah, we can call in somebody, you know. That's how he was. And the band was like, you know. And so he was always like that. He goes, I don't know why you're playing the bass on this thing. You know, we could just bring in so-and-so and begin to run in 2 seconds. Time is money, you know. And but he had a Texas accent. And anyway, so Frank, he was like two-sided in a way. He was very much a hit maker, but he was very open to the band's creativity. So he allowed us total freedom when we really didn't have any. The record company had creative control over us, but Frank allowed us to experiment in the studio. We did stuff that you don't normally get to do, like turning the tape upside down and doing reverse echo, and me starting Strawberries Mean Love with my pick inside of a grand piano, and I strummed, you know, Mark put his foot on the sustain and I went, it's, you know, we had fun in the studio, whereas, you know, it's almost like I think we had more fun than most other bands. Like at the time, even like the Birds, they were bringing in studio guys, you know, to do stuff. They didn't with us. We got threatened, but that was it. We got our act together, but we were only 18 years old too.
Right.
You know, so, but it whipped us into shape. But also the record company. Okay, so after the first album went to like number 11 in the country.
Yeah, I've seen that 11. Yeah,
really successful, and they wanted. So there's more to the Incense and Peppermint story.
Okay,
you know, the Incense and Peppermint story doesn't end with it just coming out and becoming a hit. The writing credit. Didn't Mark Weitz and Ed King got nothing ever. They were left with nothing. And the manager was a lot to blame, Bill Holmes. He was insisting that his name go on it because he paid for the sessions. And he was doing that before when the Sixpence, there's a couple of songs that say Bill Holmes on the writing credit. It was actually Mark Weitz or one of the other guys. But he was putting his name on it because he paid for the session. Well, Frank Slay said, no, it doesn't work that way. See, there's another Frank Slay who was kind of the okay guy. But then Frank got really mad at Bill Holmes because Frank said, I'm sitting in the copyright. Who are the writers? And he goes, well, it's Mark and Ed and he goes, myself. And he goes, no, you're not on it. And he goes, well, we want to put everybody in the band's name. And pretty soon Frank got totally fed up with the whole thing and said, boom, send it. He sent in the copyright with only John Carter and Carter's songwriting partner.
Okay.
It was a la Lennon McCartney kind of thing. And it was Tim Gilbert, but he didn't happen to write anything on this particular song. So it never got resolved. And so after the single goes to number one, the album's going to number 11, the manager decides we've got to make it up to Mark and Ed. We've got to let them write a song, a new song, the follow-up single. Well, they should have been taking follow-up singles off of the first album. Dick Clark, he was our friend at the time.
Yeah.
And he even said, I really, really love Birds in My Tree. I think you guys should record that as a single. And, you know, it was one of his favorite songs.
And you wrote that, you co-wrote that with Bartek.
Yes. Yeah. And it was the flip side of Tomorrow.
That's of Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So Mark and Ed went in and wrote Tomorrow, but the album hadn't finished its thing. And then they released this single that's not on that album. And the next album isn't going to be ready for 4 or 5 months. And on top of it, the version was so rushed that the band was unhappy with it, especially Ed of Tomorrow, that he wanted to re-record his guitar solo. He played bass on it, and he wanted to re-record the bass part and everything else. And so when we were doing the album, Tomorrow was completely came out different. And it's really a lot better. It would have been a better single, and they should have gone. And what ended up happening, because of that total dumb delay thing that they did, the second album didn't chart even. After a hit album and a hit single, and then Tomorrow, they rushed that. It went to number 23 and fell off. And then there's no album for it.
It did better in Cashbox. It actually was like top 15 in Cashbox.
Tomorrow. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I like reading Cashbox a little bit more because my favorite songs always seem to do a little bit better at Cashbox than they did in Billboard, you know?
Yeah. Cashbox was fun. Yeah. You know what? Here's a silly little side note. When in the 80s, my wife and I moved into a house we rented, and it was owned by the next door neighbor, and his name was Eddie Adlam, and he was the editor of Cashbox.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He knew all about everything, you know. And he said, I remember you guys coming up to the magazine in New York, you know. So, yeah. And
Well, the single Tomorrow is Rushed, then when the second album is actually recorded, Wake Up, It's Tomorrow, the song is redone.
Yeah.
And Ed is happy with that second version, the album version of
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He got his sustained guitar, you know, the guitar solo ends with a long, long sustain, you know.
So how was the band doing through all this period? Because after the song Inside the Peppermint hits, you did a lot of shows on the road, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what? And then the second album comes up. What's the turnover like? Is it still the same guys or in the band from when?
They had the bass player that they didn't really like the other bass player, Gary Levine. And so I didn't have any say so in it. But they decided to take him off of bass completely. We were both playing bass at the same time. and I was playing, but I was playing other things. I had a Vox Mini Mando, and it was actually just a little 12-string guitar, a miniature thing. And I played regular guitar with fuzz in it and everything, and did special effects, and I played percussion a lot. And then bass on a few songs, and at the same time that Gary was playing, so it was a little odd, but it was okay. It was working out. But then the band didn't want him playing anymore, and so they made him the road manager.
Oh, okay.
And so he was the road manager after the first album. He didn't play on the second album, and I did. Me and Ed played on everything. And same with the third album. And the third album, because the second album, here's where the record went back to your thing about the outside influence of the managers and stuff. Well, the record company blamed it on us, the whole, you know, fiasco with the second album not charting. And they were saying because it was too, you know, creative and, you know, esoteric and this and that, and so they just completely put the blend, not commercial, you know. And although there was a couple of singles on it, you know, Sit with the Guru and, you know, Tomorrow, but I didn't think of it as our fault. I thought that we made a nice album, but it was, you know, screwed up because of the timing. And and so they, on the third album, they brought in strings and outside songwriters. They decided that we couldn't write our own stuff, that we shouldn't be writing. So they brought in Carol King and Tony Stern and Bob Stone, the guy that wrote Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves. He wrote Angry Young Man.
Right. Okay.
And Carole King wrote two songs for us, and they were, I liked her songs, you know, but it was still, we were into the idea of writing songs, you know, and they just kind of pulled the rug out from under us. The third album, the first one half of it is songs that we wrote, and then the other, but they were bringing in a lyricist too, this guy Roy Freeman, nice guy, and it was their idea to bring him in and try to, you know, make coherent lyrics. And I guess Rainy Day Mushroom Pella wasn't cutting it. And so they brought him in, and he wrote the Sit with the Guru lyrics, you know. And then Ed King and Lee Freeman wrote They Saw the Fat One Coming about Roy Freeman. So it's, and they're on the same, you know, album. You know, it's like that song is pretty cool. And anyway, they didn't get any of it, the record company. And so eventually I quit after the third album, and so did Randy. And there was more to it.
What year is that, George? What
68. It was the end of 68. And we went back to our band, Waterford Train, but they had changed their name when they brought Steve and our friend Bruce Hubbard in. They changed it to Public Bubble.
Okay,
Public and Bubble. Yeah. As a matter of fact, they opened for the Alarm Clock at the Hullabaloo Club in Hollywood, and we were opening for Love. But the Public Bubble was the first opening act, and Arthur Lee loved Steve's flute playing and called Steve up on stage, excuse me, to play Revelation live with a long thing with a long flute solo. And he heard Steve playing with his band, with Public Bubble, and thought, oh, this guy's great, I want him. But that was Steve's, like, one of his favorite moments, you know, in history.
So you leave before that fourth album, I can't remember the name of the last album. But
oh, Good Morning Starshine.
Good Morning Starshine. Before that, the band appeared in a couple of films.
We were in Psych Out. Yeah, and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls was after Good Morning Starshine.
Okay, so first let's talk about a moment about Psych Out. So I'd heard that Ed King had taught Jack Nicholson how to play guitar enough so Nicholson could fake it in the movie.
Yes, you know, Jack Nicholson was not famous yet. I mean, he was just in these really B movies, and he was like a star in this movie, but he was not the main star. And so, but he was, you could tell he was really into acting.
Yeah.
And so was the director, Richard Rush. And they wanted to be accurate. You know, he didn't want to look stupid.
Yeah.
He wanted his hands in the right place for the right things, you know. And so Ed showed him. He didn't know how to play guitar. And Ed did. He put his fingers. He held his fingers. Put no, right? You know, yeah. He put his fingers where they needed to be. It was really, really good. He was a funny guy, Jack Nicholson. He was great. He got us stoned, you know. Yeah. You know, they used to carry pot around in little film canisters, little aluminum 35 millimeter film canister.
Yeah. You
know? And so he had this, he unscrewed it, you know, the top, and he goes, smell this. You know, and it was like skunk, you know, and it was like, you know, and up to that point, I'd never even heard of anything like that. It pot was like in a baggie with sticks and stems and seeds. half powder, and it was Mexican pot. And this thing was like, it had red hairs on it, and it was crystallized. And he pulled this little bud out of that little canister, and I was like, what in the world is that? And he goes, wait till you try it. And so, I mean, we were at the Cheetah Club in Venice. It was at One Navy Street in Venice. And it used to be called the Aragon Ballroom. Anyway, we were in the parking garage down below. And he had a joint of it, and passed it around. He said, here, take a hit. It was, my lungs were caved in from it. You know, it was like, no. I thought, what is this? You know? And so anyway, that was it. One hit. And the rest of us were all the same way. We were all coughing. Nobody could go past the one hit. And here's a little thing about that, though. We were on a break. And during that break, Randy Seal, our drummer, had to go to traffic school. He didn't know that. He thought we were just going to do our part and we'd be done and leave.
Right.
But he was supposed to go to traffic school for a speeding ticket. And so he goes, I can't stay. I have to go to traffic school or they'll take my license away. And so he left, and we still had to, you know, we were in the middle of a scene. They filmed us in the Cheetah Club, and we were on stage. And the camera comes across the band and shows the whole band, and it's a chase scene in there with Bruce Dern and whoever else it was, and then right at the end of where they get to the end of the band, they yell cut, and we're like, you know, okay. And so, okay, everybody, we're going to take a 2-hour break. That's when this happened. And so we went down. So then when we came back, we were stoned for one thing. And then we didn't have Randy. So it been in that we were performing a Rainy Day Mushroom Pillow. And Randy was sitting, he had a regular little chair, and he had his feet on the seat part, and he was sitting his butt on the back of the chair playing bongos.
Uh-huh.
And with the microphone there. Anyway, I was playing flute. And so when it panned back after this chase scene and it came back, I'm sitting up there playing bongos. There's no Randy around. Ed changed his guitar to a Telecaster. He was supposed to be using a Vox because we're sponsored by Vox. And Mark put a bumper sticker that said Pastime with the Strawberry Alarm Clock on the front of his organ. So the whole thing was pretty funny. And we messed with their continuity and they didn't even notice it. So into the details that they didn't even pay attention to what we were goofing around with.
So now the other film, is Russ Meyer's classic, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. So you were not part of that shooting?
No, I had left the band before that happened. And Mark wasn't part of it either, Mark Weitz. He left the band after the fourth album, after Good Morning Starshine. And Paul Marshall came in to the band. And Jimmy Pittman, who was the singer on the fourth album. And he left also.
Yeah. Well, on that soundtrack to Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I think it's Paul Marshall maybe singing on the song I'm Coming Home, which is a pretty cool song on the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's like the Ozzy Osbourne song.
Yes.
There's the Ozzy Osbourne song called I'm Coming Home. And it's the same thing. I thought, I wonder why those guys never said anything to Ozzy about it, you know?
Oh, so one more thing about Psych Out, that I think the Seeds are also in the film. Were they a band that you performed with regularly or on occasion?
Yeah, we knew them. They were funny. Daryl Hoover was a totally normal guy, you know? And the rest of them were kind of kooky. And yeah, it but we had fun with them, you know. Even later, in later years, we did shows with them. I was, okay, so I took a break from touring in 1986 and started selling cars. And I did that for 29 years, but I kept playing the whole time. I kept touring. And I was friends with all these funny people. And one day I was at a Mercedes dealership, and in walks Sky Saxon and Spanky McFarlane of Spanky and Our Gang. They were hanging out together. They were heading up to her place in like Oregon or somewhere. And the people that, you know, I'm wearing like this three-piece suit, you know, it's like I was able to do different things. The rest of the band, not so much. And so Mark was. But anyway, so they walk in, and these guys that I worked with at the dealership, they're like, "What? What?" And they looked like, you know, they were like scraggly, hippie looking, you know. But they could have bought a Mercedes. And it was pretty funny.
So when the band, you know, you leave, the fourth album's done, the band is finished, then you wound up doing a reunion around 73, 74 with against Steve Bartek.
Yes.
And you have, you know, there was that, and then later on there's like another pause, and then you, when did the band become active really again? Was that in the 80s?
Well, in 74 we did the California Jam.
Okay, what's a California Jam?
That was a huge concert at the Ontario Motor Speedway. And it was like 250,000 people. It was with Deep Purple, Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And we were with this guy named Ben Balloon, Ben Schlossberg. We called him Ben Balloon. And he had a hot air balloon, and he went up into the gondola in the balloon a couple hundred feet above the band.
Yeah.
A Fender Rhodes and a bullhorn. And we were on a stage down below. We went on between Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Deep Purple with this balloon thing. And we did it was our music. And it was like avant-garde, you know, instrumental stuff. And we had a soprano sax and a clarinet and then Randy Seal and me and Steve Bartek. So it was interesting. But and then it was like, we did a few other little things in the 70s, but mostly we kind of left the balloon thing behind. We only did a couple of shows. What was it? A midnight special with what's his name there? Wolfman.
And, oh, yeah.
Which that was pretty funny. And that, and he had, you know, the gondola, and he had dancers dangling from it and stuff. Anyway, we got over that. that was 74, probably.
And then you became more active in the 80s. I mean, right now, the lineup has got, like, there's six of you guys, and five of you guys played in the band in the 60s. And out of those five guys, were you all in the lineup at the same time or at different points in the 60s?
We all played on the five of us that are in the band right now.
Yeah.
Played on the first album.
Okay.
We all did. Cause Gene played on Incense and Peppermints. And Steve played flute on The World's on Fire and on Rainy Day Mushroom Pillow and wrote songs. And then.
Including that one, right? Rainy Day Mushroom Pillow.
Yeah. Yeah,
you guys wrote that one.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to ask you here about, you are scheduled to play this year's Tiki Oasis. It's coming up later in the summer, Sunday, August the 9th. It's a long-running Tiki festival that runs this year. It's the August 5th through the 9th in San Diego. This year's got like a psychedelic theme. Tiki stuff, does that Polynesian art or music, any of that, does that have any influences to what you guys do?
A little
bit. The tiki world?
we have a song that'll be coming out right before we do that concert, and it's called Tahitian Gardens.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, it's on our new album, and it's very much tiki. It talks about tikis. It's about the apartment buildings in the San Fernando Valley in the 70s, 60s and 70s, where they were all done with Hawaiian themes. And so we called it Tahitian Gardens, like the name of an apartment complex.
Oh, cool.
But yeah. And it says, you know, you leave Canoga Avenue and then you go into this place and there's tikis everywhere, tikis on the hall, tikis on the wall. And you know, and so it talks about luau's and everything else in the song.
Well, let's talk some about you have a new album. We're going to take a listen to The Sky Isn't Falling, a new single, but about the new album. When will the new album be out?
August 7th is the release date.
So, all right. So, right, that comes out the 7th, and then the Tiki Oasis show is almost kind of like a record release party then.
Yes, it is.
Record
That's
release show.
That's what we're doing it as. We're, you know, the record company, Big Stir Records, Rex Broom and Christina Solbenko have a booth they've just worked out with Otto and Baby Doe. We had a Zoom with them, and it was really cute. And and they set up they're going to do a booth where they have the albums and we do a signing and we do photos with the fans and stuff. And somebody even brought up the idea of having somebody bringing a Polaroid camera and taking pictures and with fans and signing them right then and there.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
So the album, how many tracks is it?
I think we're at 13.
13 songs. And so does some of this feature you and Steve Bartek, some of your compositions are on there or how?
A lot of them. Yeah, I wrote, I don't even know how many. I never looked to see, but I'm a co-writer on a lot of them. And Steve is too. There's a couple of songs, three songs that Howie Anderson, our new guy,
right, the guitar, lead guitar player?
Yeah, him and Steve are both lead guitar players. And Howie has been with us since 86. And so he's a longtime member.
Right.
Besides the five of us.
And he's responsible for writing the new single, The Sky Isn't Falling.
Yeah, he wrote The Sky Isn't Falling.
And when did he write that? Do you know?
I don't know exactly when we were doing a lot of rehearsals when all the band lived here and in LA, since the drummer moved, one of the drummers moved to Mexico and the other drummer moved to Vegas. So now it's harder to get together all the time, but we do. And anyway, there's a rehearsal tape by one of our lighting director, Robert Jacobs, and he's kind of like a advisor to the band also. And he's done the Tiki Oasis show with Otto before.
Okay.
And he's going to be doing a light show there, you know, a digital and projection and liquid lights.
All right.
Yeah, he does that kind of thing. He does it for us at the Whiskey every year, Whiskey A Go-Go. And we're once a year at the Whiskey.
I have seen you at the Whiskey before.
Oh, you did?
I think twice. I've seen you twice for certain. One time was at the Whiskey, and that was with one time was with the Chocolate Watch Band.
Oh, okay.
And they had Daryl Hooper, by the way, playing.
Playing
keys with him that night.
We did a show with the Chocolate Watch Band up in. We did Fuzz Fest Northwest in Tacoma. I don't know.
It was okay, like, yeah.
It was Portland, Oregon. Sorry. But and it was with the Seeds and the Chocolate Watch Band. So maybe that's where they hooked up.
so the Howie, this the song, The Sky Isn't Falling, was that something he worked up independently and then just brought it to the band, or did you guys kind of arrange it together? Or he worked it up?
Yeah, we arranged it together. He brought it to the band. I never knew what it was. I never paid attention to what it was about. And until kind of recently, I realized that it's extraterrestrial, you know, that it's about him having one of those experiences where he's not sure if it was a dream or if it was actually happened, you know, but he saw something take off into space. And it's kind of a love story at the same time. But I'm here with you right now, you know, kind of a thing.
Have you ever had an experience like that?
No, but we did see balloons one time, and everybody in the neighborhood was, "There's a UFO!" We were kids, but it was some kind of balloon thing.
Well, very cool. We're going to take a listen to "The Sky Isn't Falling" in just a moment, but first, George, I have to thank you so much for making today's Coolest Conversation so special.
Well, hopefully, it was cool.
It was the coolest. I mean, I'm going to have to put on an extra jacket here in a minute. So cool.
Oh, I love this jacket. This is a good one.
Oh, thanks. All right. Well, let's give a listen to "The Sky Isn't Falling" from the Strawberry Alarm Clock, new single out now. You're listening to it in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Latest single, "The Sky Isn't Falling." That's a Strawberry Alarm Clock here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The song is from their forthcoming album, "Where's One," and that's due out later this summer. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to bassist George Bunnell for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Dave Hill is a musician and comedian who fronts the New York City band Valley Lodge, and they've contributed a song to the upcoming Jesse Malin tribute album, "Friends of Jesse Malin, I Would Do It For You, Volume 1, coming out on Wicked Cool Records. They cover a Degeneration tune titled "Too Loose." We'll find out all about that track and the project when Dave Hill joins us next time around on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.